24-year-old Jennifer Kessy disappeared January 24, 2006. She was last seen at her condo on Conroy Road.
We're going to solve a missing persons case, which has haunted Orlando investigators.
So we're still waiting for that one person to come through with the one bit of information that could bring Jennifer home.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of 24-year-old financial analyst Jennifer Kessy in Orlando, Florida. I'm your host, Sean Gerd. Since episode 3 was published, I've been trying to answer one very complicated question. Is it possible that there's a witness that interacted with Jennifer Kessy after she was reported missing? That question is the reason we're taking another detour on this journey. If you remember, at the end of episode 3, we planned to begin our investigation into the known possible suspects responsible for Jennifer's disappearance. But now, that has to wait. I've spent the last 12 days trying to determine if a story that I received over email about this witness interaction is real. If confirmed, it would change the entire investigation, including Jennifer's last known whereabouts and the list of possible suspects. Further, the surrounding details of this eyewitness account would become the biggest break in the case to date. So, did this witness actually see and interact with Jennifer Kessy? That's the question that we now have to consider. It's been 11 long years since Jennifer's disappearance, and anything, small or large, could be the information that makes a difference. And with that in mind, I'm going to share the details of this eyewitness event, and the witness's very own detailed words. This event places Jennifer in a small town of just over 2,000 people, some 600 plus miles from Orlando, by the name of Deckard, Tennessee, just months after her abduction.
So what really happened, I guess, is I'll start at the beginning. In 2005, my husband had retired. We moved to Middle Tennessee. I knew that no other jewelry stores around there in that part of this rural area would ever have an employee with as much experience as I had in the jewelry industry. As I told you, I'd worked all over the country. So I approached a small jewelry store. I went to work there. I did radio there. I have since, in the last 24 hours, talked to the owners. They also remember this event, hoping that what I share with you will be helpful to someone. This store became very popular because of radio. It was an hour south of Nashville, an hour west of Chattanooga, an hour north of Huntsville, Alabama. We had a lot of traffic from the larger cities, people looking to be able to buy something in a bargain, I guess you could say. I know that when this event happened, it was winter of either 2006 or 2007. I cannot offer the specific date now because there have been years that transpired. I believe it was January to March of 2006 or in the cold fall, beginning winter of 2007, somewhere in that gap of 1 year. And the reason I'm saying that is because we didn't have Christmas decorations up, and we didn't have Easter decorations up. And this store decorated with seasonal things. And those decorations were not up, but it was very, very cold. And so I know it was either in January to March of 2006 through the beginning of winter of 2007. And I'm not sure which year it was, except to say that it was very cold. It was getting dark outside. It was late in the afternoon, you know, 4 to 4:30-ish. The door rang as someone opened it, and I came from behind the payment counter and walked to the front of the store. It was a very narrow store. There was a very dark black male who was extremely fashionably dressed. He stood out in that part of Tennessee because we didn't see that kind of clothing in that area. It was a much more rural and casual dress area. And this guy was dressed to the T's, totally in black and white. He had black and white tennis shoes on with an open tongue that was kind of flapping outwardly. Very expensive tennis shoes, although I'm not good at identifying what brand they were. I know they weren't Nike. We'll put it that way. He was wearing black tight jeans with a coat on that was black and white, I would say brand new. He had dreadlocks that were very long down the middle of his back. He did not have a hood on that coat. They were very nice dreadlocks. Again, stands out in southern Tennessee. He was a very black man. He was not brown. His skin was not a chocolate or coffee color. He was very black with a wider nose. His eyes were not distinguishable of any kind that I would say stood out. He did have a stone, a clear stone, that I interpreted to be a diamond and not a CZ. It was a square cut stone in his left ear. For safety reasons, in a jewelry store, when two or more people come in like that, you immediately become aware that you need to be alert. And he was pulling behind him a girl by the wrist. I would say that she was not trying to, resist being pulled in. She came in willingly, but he had a grip on her wrist, and it would have been her right wrist. It was not a grip on her hand. Once they came in, he went to the first counters of jewelry with her, which in the front of a jewelry store don't always have the very best jewelry, but there was rings, lots of colored stone rings. I went up there and I started opening the case to show different things. I'm doing my retail job because I don't yet know what's transpiring. And so I'm talkative, I'm chatty. He left us. He went deeper in the store. That sometimes in a jewelry store, when two people separate, can make you become aware of safety. He was going toward our diamond counters, and he's left this girl with me. And so I used a code word. One of the owners at the back of the store stood up and became active watching the situation, but didn't see any reason for alarm, nor did I. But it gave me time to look at the girl that he had brought into the store. She was approximately 5'7". I do not know for sure that she was any more past that. She was very thin. She was, in my opinion, had experienced a broken nose because her nose had a knot at the ridge and was not completely straight. I did not think this was a recent injury, but it was a visible characteristic of her nose. And her skin was really odd for Tennessee because it was almost honey colored, and you don't see that in the cold weather in Tennessee. People are staying indoors. So it was like maybe she had had a tan, and it was an older tan. She had a grayish, I called it sallow look. I attributed it to being thin, maybe not having eaten. She had no makeup on. There was shadows under both of her eyes. And I even wondered if she was dehydrated because she had this little grayish tint. That I would have thought, you know, someone would have if they weren't well. I felt an immediate concern for her welfare because now I'm alone with her and I'm looking at her. Her eyes were sunken. Her hair was not clean. I could tell if it had been clean, it would have been beautiful hair. It was long, but it was what my mom would have called long and stringy because it hadn't been combed. And it hadn't been cleaned. It was bunched in and out of her collar. And it was, her coat had a hood. So some of her hair was actually in that hood. She was wearing blue jeans that I did not believe belonged to her. They were at least a size or two too big. I did not know it at that point, but I was able to see later that the hem was ratty. Anyway, she was wearing the blue jeans. I didn't think they belonged to her. They drugged the ground. I could tell that she was wearing a cotton type blouse. And that is, again, something that we didn't see in Tennessee in the wintertime because it's too cold. And she was wearing a coat. Now, the coat, I will never forget. It was a darker blue on the outside with gray on the inside. It was not her coat. It was at least two sizes too big. It hung off of her hands so that she was pushed it back whenever I would hand her a ring to look at. It was not clean. It had stains on it. And my impression, I thought at the time, was that it was a thrift store coat. I wondered if she was homeless. But it looked like she was almost shrunk inside that coat, as if she were huddling in it for safety and not just for warmth. At one point, I did look at her shoes. And I can tell you that that's something that my husband always told me to do, was to look at shoes of anyone that I was concerned about. Her particular shoes were not her shoes. They were clearly too big for her. I would have said they were at least a size 10 or 11. She had them tied super tight to stay on her feet. I did not see if she was wearing socks because the hem of her blue jeans hung too far over her shoes. But she did have to accommodate the shoes when she walked, and they were old. So anyway, I started my chatty routine at the counter. She was almost non-responsive to me initially. The black man that had come in with her asked her, he walked back up there where we were because he heard me talking to her, and he asked if she saw anything in that case that she liked, and she shook her head no. I tried to involve him in the conversation as if they were a couple, and that is my normal routine in a jewelry store. She didn't see anything in that counter, so as an employee, it's my responsibility to help her locate something, in, you know, that she's going to like. So when he moves to the next counter, I'm immediately locking that case and talking and moving to the next counter. I took out numerous items and showed her. And each time she shook her head no. She didn't say no. She shook her head no. He was growing more irritated and agitated, as if he had thought this was going to be a quick thing, that he would find something that she liked, and she was not liking anything at all. I felt after that second ring case, as he moved around toward the pearls, I didn't stand a chance of her liking anything in the pearl case. But I did state that was our pearls. They are harder to maintain. And he went back toward where our diamond pendants were, and he called her that direction. So I come out of this front island, and I go down to the diamond pendants. Again, I'm showing different things. Inside of myself, I felt his growing agitation. I was concerned, not only for her, really, to be honest, I didn't feel comfortable. And I thought, clearly, something now is going on, and I don't understand it. This is not a normal couple. They're not in love, and they're not in there to buy a romantic gift. He's having me take out necklace after necklace after necklace, and every time she's shaking her head no, and I'm searching for a way to keep the conversation going. I, at that point, looked up, and I knew that the owner of the store had come out from the back of the store, and he had made himself known. That way, safety-wise, anyone in there knew the store was covered. I didn't feel like our store was being scouted for a robbery. I knew something else was going on. The black man demanded that she pick out something in those diamond pendants. And I showed her many pieces, and she shook her head no each time. I expounded the features and the benefits of each piece. And she never spoke to me. She kept her eyes down, and she would continually shake her head no. He went to a case that was paralleling the case where the pendants were. The case he went to contained engagement rings. And when he goes over there, I know that I have to follow. So I'm closing up the case, making sure everything's locked. I walk over there, and she goes slowly behind me, and he's already over there. He looks in that case. He's angry. He tried to get her to say that she liked this one or that one, and she's looking through that glass case, and she's shaking her head no. And then I saw her pause, and she stopped. In that case, in a corner, we were spotlighting jewelry that had three diamonds. This is called three stone jewelry, or past, present, and future jewelry. It is all jewelry that has three diamonds. I saw her looking in that area, and I knew that it had caught her attention. Now, he has lost tolerance. He has walked past her to the next case, which is men's jewelry, and he's looking at stainless steel jewelry. I'm seeing her focus on these three stones, and so I handed her a three-stone diamond ring and suggested that she put it on. She did. She accepted it with her left hand, and I saw her slide it on using her right hand, but I didn't look at her right hand much then, and she put her right hand down. I asked her in almost a whisper if she was okay. She would not look at me, and she did not nod. She seemed to be locked in a focus on that three-stone ring as if it was just locked on it. She would not stop staring at that three-stone ring. I got out a matching three-stone necklace, and she took it in her hand, and she looked at it for a long time. Now, It is not normal for me to ever have two pieces of jewelry out of a case. I don't do that. Anyone who's ever worked with me will tell you that. But I'm trying to get some contact with her because I have decided she's in trouble. And I'm again trying to whisper if she's okay. He is not hearing us. He's far enough down the case. He's not paying attention. But she's not hearing me whisper either. I thought maybe she was drugged because she is so focused on this 3-stone jewelry. He looked up, and I knew I had to cover that I had been asking her if she was okay. So I remarked she found one that she liked, and he said, let me see. He comes down the case. Now I am aware I've got two pieces of jewelry outside the case, and he could grab either one and run with it. So I'm getting a little uncomfortable. I ask her which one she liked the most, and I'm trying to take the necklace away and get it back in the case so that I'm just leaving her with that 3-stone ring. She's still focused on it. She does look back at that pendant, but she's focused on the ring. And he asked her. He did not use complete sentences. He said something like, you like that? You like that? Answer me. You like that one? She nodded. He said, you know what you've got to do then, don't you? Now, he said some other comments to her, but they were very low spoken. I could not hear what he was saying to her. I do have some minor hearing loss. I didn't know what he was saying, but it was between the two of them that he was getting her to understand what she had to do and that he was going to come back and buy her that ring. To be honest, at that point, I was very aware that he was either blackmailing her or he was buying her. And I didn't know which one it was, but I felt like I needed to keep her in the store as long as I could. I was afraid that he would try to grab her and run, and she still had the ring in her hand. She handed me the ring back with her left hand. I had some comments about, is that the one you really like? We can size it for free and all this. And she nodded at me. She had the most beautiful long fingers. My mother would have called them piano fingers. Her fingernails had been well cared for at some point. They were not dirty. They were not torn. They were totally not the fingernails of a woman with unclean, stringy hair and a coat that is clearly not hers or shoes that are flopping on her feet. The black man now is no longer impatient. He has used that ring to extort from her some kind of a commitment. But I didn't fully know what that commitment was, except that she knew what he was talking about. He kind of sauntered toward the front of the store again, and he was up there long enough for me to decide that I was going to put forward my right hand and try to shake hands with her. I put forth my hand. I announced my name. I wanted her to hear my name because I wanted her to tell me her name. I was hoping it would catch her off guard. So I put forth my hand, and it, without any pause whatsoever, she immediately brought up that right hand and put it forward to shake mine. It was a very smooth move. She knew exactly what she was doing. It was automatic. It was something she was very comfortable doing that she had probably done many times. She didn't pause. She didn't hesitate. Her right hand just came right up and went out. And I gripped her extended right hand. And when I did, she cried out. I gasped and I looked down. I immediately was apologizing. Her right hand had very clearly been crushed. it was black. I would say it was not a wound that day. I would say it was at least a week old because there was green showing. It was swollen towards the wrist. I felt like she had been abused severely or tortured. The hand, I know, had broken bones in it. I have raised children. I know broken bones. That hand had been broken and was never set. She did not give me her name. He heard her cry out, and she pulled that right hand back to her chest and stomach area and was holding it. And he's now walking back. As I said, I apologized. I knew I'd lost my chance as soon as she cried out. He grabbed her by the arm, and he started pulling her toward the door. I played my role as a retail salesperson, and I followed them. I'm giving them my card. I'm telling them to come back. I can give them this great price. I'm doing whatever I can to keep following them so I have an excuse to be in the doorway. I watched them go out of the store. They went to a black car that was, it was not a Toyota. It was not a Mercedes. It could have been a Lexus. I'm not real educated on cars, but in my recollection, it only had two doors, and therefore, I don't know that Lexus comes with two doors. She was put in the back seat, and he was on the passenger side, which leads me to know there was a third party in that vehicle that was driving. I could not see their car tag. I did not have my glasses on. I could not see where their tag was from, but I watched to see how they pulled out of the parking lot. When they pulled out of the parking lot, they went left. The only major cities you can get to by going left out of that parking lot was Chattanooga or Huntsville, Alabama. To get to Huntsville, Alabama, you have to go through back roads that are two lanes that used to be wagon roads. To get to Chattanooga, you hit an interstate. It was my general feeling that they were headed toward Chattanooga and Atlanta. After this event, we gathered in the store. All of us knew we had seen a really tragic event, and it did drive us within 24 hours to get posters for abused women and begin to represent that in the store. I cried. I was heartbroken. I told my family about this. I knew that girl was in trouble, and I would never see her again. So time passed. My husband's job moved us. We moved. And then, earlier this year, in 2017, my mother-in-law in Florida was very sick and dying. And we were going down every other week and staying a week at a time. I happened to catch on television a story of someone who was named Jennifer Kessy. I think that's how the name was pronounced. I watched it. I told my husband. We went over it. He knew everything that had happened in the event in that jewelry store. And I was convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that that girl was Jennifer. I knew that it was her. It looked just like her. I went on the internet to find more pictures because I was not initially seeing the girl that was in the store, her hair was not in an equal part. It was uneven. Women understand that terminology. I was able to find online pictures of her with her hair that way. I was also able to see what I called this bump on the ridge of her nose. The final thing that convinced me was an obscure comment, because I looked for 2 days and I found an obscure comment by someone that she was missing a 3-stone diamond pendant. And that is the only thing that this girl remotely liked in our jewelry store, and I could not break her focus on a 3-stone diamond pendant and diamond ring. I don't know if her fiancé had talked to her about 3-stone rings, but that is the only thing that the girl in the jewelry store was even looking at. I felt positive this was her beyond any shadow of a doubt. I did confer with my husband, who was very aware that day of what had happened, and I called the Orlando police to report that I had seen her, but I had seen her in 2006 or 2007 and did not know her name or who she was until I had seen something while staying in Florida with my mother-in-law. They put me on hold. They gave me a phone number for a tip line. I called. I gave my brief synopsis of what I've just gone in some length here with you. And I never heard anything for over a week and a half, and it bothered me. They'd given me a password, so I went back to see if there was any interest in it. I was able to be transferred to a live human being who recited back to me everything I had said in my original tip, and she assured me that the police had the information, and that included my contact information, because I felt like they would need to ask me questions, and no one has ever contacted me.
When was that you contacted the police?
It was this year, in 2017. Let's see, it would have been, I'm going to say between December and January. It couldn't have been December. My mother-in-law passed away in February, so it was between Christmas and February.
How sure are you that the person that you saw was Jennifer Kessie? Like, for example, if you were going to rank it on a scale of 1 to 10.
She was a 10. She was a 10. In the jewelry business, you learn to recognize your clientele by face, and you learn for your own personal safety how to identify those who come in the store. Now, as I've mentioned to you, my husband was in law enforcement. He has told me time and again how to protect myself in a store where I was a manager. I have been in stores where there were robberies. I know how important it is. I'm not telling you that I remember the details of every customer who ever has encountered me in any jewelry store I've ever managed over the United States. But I am telling you that that day I put to memory and recorded everything I could remember about that girl, because I expected to see it in the newspaper. And I never saw anything. I never heard anything. I never saw her again. And I felt like it was just a fleeting event. I went on about my life. I feel heartbroken for the parents, but I did not know who she was until this year.
Lisa also shared some details about the direction she believed the car was heading as it left her jewelry store.
There had been a history of human trafficking out of Florida that went through Atlanta. Where we were living is maybe 2.5 hours from Atlanta if you drove it slow. The car, when it left that parking lot, went the direction where they either had to go to Chattanooga or they had to go to Huntsville. And there is nothing in Huntsville, Alabama. So we generally felt that day that the vehicle was going toward Chattanooga. Not that it's important, you know, but that's what we felt because there's just nothing in Chattanooga. I mean, in Huntsville.
So what does this all mean? And let's be honest, it's all a big if. And over the last week, I've been conflicted. Whether this story is real or not, and whether it meant something or it didn't mean anything at all. I just kept thinking, is this just more misinformation? I wondered so many times if this is even worth sharing. But this is what I kept coming back to. For every second that I doubted whether this story could be about Jennifer Kesey, I also had to ask myself, what if it is? What if it is about Jennifer? How can we not share it, discuss it, and investigate it? And really, there's two parts to this. First, we have to determine if Lisa is real, and is she telling the truth? And the second part we have to determine is if the person she saw is actually Jennifer. Now, it's actually kind of sad that the first question even has to be asked. But as you've heard from Jennifer's mom, people can be cruel. They can make things up and try to insert themselves into horrible situations. But I'll say right now, I believe Lisa. I believe that she witnessed this event over a decade ago. And she may not like hearing this, but I looked into her a bit, and she's a real person. I checked in with the jewelry store that this event took place, and I've confirmed enough that I believe Lisa and I believe her story. But with that determined, the bigger question is that second part. Was the girl that Lisa so vividly remembers actually Jennifer Kesey? And the sad reality is, we may never know. I know Lisa believes 100% that it's Jennifer. But is that enough? Of course not. But even if it was, it still means that there's further investigation that must be explored. And to this point, our investigation continues, with yet another direction to consider. Now, Scott and I are working on some things behind the scenes on this, and we hope to be able to share them with you soon. But at the same time, we just can't leave everything else behind. So at this point, the only thing I'm comfortable saying for sure is that I don't think Lisa is an internet troll, and I believe that this event occurred. And as such, we're going to continue to look into the possibilities of Jennifer Kesey crossing paths with this witness in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee. Now, as you heard Lisa mention, and you're probably thinking as well, this story seems to align itself with the theory of human trafficking. And that's a theory that Jennifer's parents have had as well.
You know how trafficking works. You know, there's a coyote who brings them here from Mexico, whether they come by boat or they come, you know, in the back of a van. Well, what if somebody didn't have the money to pay their coyote?
We'll pick up with that and this possible new lead next time on Unconcluded. Don't forget that you need to participate in this podcast too. If we're going to make progress, you're going to have to be part of it. You can find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, all of them at Unconcluded Pod. There's also a new group that's been set up by some of our listeners. If you search on Facebook for Unconcluded Podcast Discussion Group, you're going to find a ton of people discussing this case and the podcast. We'd love to see you in there. Don't forget that you can also participate in our sidebar episodes, where we answer questions and comments and discuss theories. You can do that on social media, but you can also call our voicemail line and have your voice on the show. You can find that number on unconcluded.com. Now, before I go, I want to end this episode with something that I should have ended every episode with. And that is to say, if you know something, anything, about Jennifer Kesey's disappearance, please come forward. You can be anonymous, and you can be the key to solving this thing. We'll be back next week with our second sidebar episode, and in 2 weeks with episode 5. Unconcluded is produced by Scott J. and myself. We'll see you next time.